Any questions about anything from last time?
I thought it's worth spending some more time on the Poisson formula since it kind of just summarized what it was all about last time. You remember I wrote out a Fourier series solution to the famous Dirichlet problem on the disk. We're looking for harmonic functions that have prescribed boundary values on the disk. And I came up with a formula for it. I had some questions at the end of last hour from people who were confused about some of the meaning of these symbols. So, to clarify, you know how we've been writing Fourier series now in this form, as n goes from minus infinity to infinity of cn e to the I n theta. And to say that that converges means, so we're going to say that converges, it means that two limits exist. Namely, that if we were to sum the negative term, so that would be the sum, as n goes from minus 1, let's see, I'll make it, yeah, so I'll make n go from 1 to infinity and take the minus terms. So that's the left end of the series. So it means this, that's, and the positive side of the series, that would be the sum as n goes from 0 to infinity, cn e to the I n theta. So I split that sum into two pieces, which are both infinite, all the negative terms and all the positive terms. And so if I say that thing converges, it means that these both converge. And so there was questions about what if I was rearranging a series or not. And I'm never really rearranging series. I'm just pulling it into two halves. Were there any more questions about that? Yeah.
So in the book, they define the partial sum as from negative n to n. And
right.
Then they say that converges.
Right.
Is that a different definition than this?
Is it? I don't think so.
Because suppose you had a series with all the negative terms were just negative 1, and all the positives were just 1, like all the cn positives were 1, and all the cn ends are negative, negative 1.
Convergence in Fourier series is such that when we have convergence, we have both of these things converging. So what we were doing is we were studying a Fourier series. Remember, we'd had a naught plus the sum as n goes from 1 to capital N, a n cosine n theta, plus b n sine n theta. And when we replaced sine and cosine with e to the I theta, n theta, etc. over 2 or 2i, then we were able to write this as a sum as n goes from minus capital N to capital N of cn e to the I n theta. So it always turns out that this converges exactly when the negative sum converges plus the positive sum. So that's what I'm going to mean when I say that converges. That's a sort of a tradition in complex analysis too. If you study Laurent expansions, when you say something like this converges, it means you split it into two series, the negative terms and the positive terms, and they both converge. So that's what I'm going to mean when I say that. Anyway, there was nothing, I didn't do any rearrangement of my series. When I was studying the Poisson kernel, I would take this nth partial sum. So remember I had my Poisson kernel P of theta. That would be a limit as n goes to infinity. And it, remember it was the sum as n goes from minus n to capital N, and I had R to the absolute N. So the R was always positive. Let's see, I'm trying to write up. Let me be more careful. This would be a limit as capital N goes to infinity, and I would have A naught plus the sum as N goes from 1 to capital N of A, and remember the R to the N's came in here, cosine N theta. These were the individual solutions to the separation of variables problem. So BN, R to the N, sine N theta. That was the solution I got by thinking about separation of variables and adding up a series. And then the deal is, I can split that into, I can turn that into a complex sum. And the complex sum looked like summation as n goes from minus n to capital N of Cn, the r's were always, it was always a positive power. So even though those n's are being negative, the r to the n is always r to a positive power. That's why I'm taking absolute n here. And then this turned out to be e to the I n theta. Actually, I'm sorry, this is not my p of n, this is my solution. And then what I did last hour was mess around with this and realize this is an integral. And so that's what I played around with last time. Okay, so this turned out to be an integral from minus pi to pi, and that this, I got a geometric sum that I could actually calculate the limit. And this thing in the here was the Poisson kernel, r theta, and it'd be an integral with respect to t of f of t dt. Okay, so I messed around most of the hour last time and got this thing called the Poisson kernel. And I would, so remember the Poisson kernel was p of r theta t. When I sum the geometric series, I got 1 minus r squared on the top. On the bottom, I got 2 pi, and I got here the absolute value, the modulus rather, of 1 minus r e to the I theta minus t squared. That's the Poisson kernel. And today I want to mess around with the Poisson kernel a little bit and get a better picture of it, what it does. Any questions about anything from last time? So one thing I can do is mess around with that thing in the denominator. So notice that if I multiply, so that thing in the denominator is 1 minus r e to the I theta minus t. I can multiply that by e to the I theta t. I'm sorry, e to the I t. That's 1. That would be cosine squared plus sine squared, square root. That's on the unit circle. That has length modulus 1. And if I move that inside that that absolute value thing, this would be equal to the modulus of e to the it minus r, and then the e to the plus it would cancel out this e to the minus it, and so I'd get r e to the I theta. That's an easier thing to analyze, and I would draw a picture of what that represents now. So if I look on the unit circle, e to the it would be a point on the unit circle. And r e to the I theta would be a point in here somewhere. So this is r e to the I theta. And so this distance, let's see, I've got here. This distance would be an r. This is the unit circle, so that distance would be a 1. This angle right here is a theta. And this angle right here is a t. And so if I look at this, then I realize, aha, this distance is the modulus, e to the it minus r e to the I theta. And I can use the law of cosines to write out what that is. So this is equal to, by the law of cosines, let's see, let me square these things. So there, it's squared in the denominator. And the law of cosines says that this distance squared is, it's like the Pythagorean theorem, is this distance squared plus this distance squared, but the correction term for a non-right angle is minus 2 times r times 1 times the cosine of that angle. And so it's the law of cosines that says this is equal to 1 squared plus r squared minus 2 times r times 1 times the cosine of the angle between them. And let's see, that'd be the same as cosine theta minus t. Because cosine is even. Cosine of t minus theta is the same as the cosine of theta minus t. And then we'd have a plus r squared. So the famous formula for the Poisson kernel is P of r theta t equals 1 minus r squared over 2 pi times 1 minus 2r cosine theta minus t plus r squared. Nice and clean. So I took an infinite sum and used geometric series of complex numbers to come up with that formula. But it's fairly, it's straightforward. By the way, when I was estimating those errors, does anybody have questions about estimating the errors when I was summing the geometric series? Maybe not. I felt like I did it carefully once, so maybe I did it quickly last time. But the key properties of the Poisson kernel that I mentioned last time and now are pretty easy to read off. One, it's positive. You just look at the formula and say, yep, that's positive. After all, that thing in the denominator is a distance squared, so it's definitely positive. Well, that's positive, but notice when I get on the bound on the circle, then it's a tricky thing, because 1 minus r squared would go to 0. So it's positive when r is not equal to 1.
So I should say it's strictly positive when the r is not equal to 1. Check. When r is equal to 1, we got to think about it, because that's when it gets delicate. Number 2, its integral is always 1. That looks like it might be a hard thing to verify. So if I just integrate with respect to t, I always get 1. And that's also when r is less than 1. Well, the easy way to see that is to write out what the Poisson kernel was. So let's see here. Here's y. The Poisson kernel, remember, was the sum. There's going to be a 1 over 2 pi in front times the sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity of r to the absolute n e to the I n theta minus t.
And the integral of these things over an interval of length 2 pi is all zero, except for the one that's the constant term. So this falls out because the integral of these things is all zero. So integral of this equals zero if n is unequal to zero. And the n equals zero term is just one.
So this is the integral of p dt. It's just going to be the 1 over 2 pi, the integral from minus pi to pi of the r to the 0 dt. And r to the 0 is 1. And so we get 2 pi times 1 over 2 pi. Or I should say 1 over 2 pi times 2 pi. So that's easy to check, just from the definition of what the Poisson kernel is. The third key property was that the Poisson kernel is very small away from the spot where it's actually big. So number three I'm going to do with a picture. I'll take my unit circle again. And I'm going to take an e to the I theta right here. And then I'm going to take a little disk of radius delta about that spot. So let's take... here's a disk of radius delta over 2. And here's a disk of radius delta. So this one has... radius delta over 2, and this one has radius delta. Delta over 2. And what I'm going to do is consider e to the it's, which are out here in the rest of this circle. So this is where my e to the it is going to be. And I want my r e to the I theta to be really close to this point out here. So my r e to the I theta is going to be in here.
What I claim is that it's easy to estimate the Poisson kernel now when that's the picture.
So let's think about it. The Poisson kernel that's equal to 1 over 2 pi 1 minus r squared on the top, and on the bottom I've got the distance from e to the it minus that r e to the I theta squared.
Well, what's the closest, though, if e to the it is in that blue part, what's the closest those two things can get together? Anybody want to yell it out?
Delta.
Let's see, yeah, the red dot and the black dot are never closer than delta. But the black dot, the r e to the I theta, it could kind of sneak up and get the closest spot. Yeah, if it let r sneak up to that corner up there.
So it would be delta over 2,
yeah.
So this thing in the bottom, I claim, is always bigger than delta over 2. So the e to the it minus, if I keep it like the picture here, this is going to be bigger than delta over 2. And so my Poisson kernel is going to be less than or equal to 1 over 2 pi 1 minus r squared delta over 2 squared in the bottom, since that
That reverses that inequality.
And now I'm going to mess around and write this as 1 minus r squared is equal to 1 minus r plus times 1 plus r. So that's my 1 minus r squared on top, and I get delta over 2 squared on the bottom.
And 1 plus r, r is in the unit circle, so this is less than
1 plus 1. So this 1 plus 1 is less than or equal to 2. 1 plus r is less than or equal to 2. And so I claim that when I collect all that together, I get that this is less than or equal to 4 over pi delta, let's see, pi delta squared times 1 minus r.
So if r is in there, I can make that thing small on the whole blue part of the circle.
Okay. So I want to write down something for that blue part of that circle. So this is on the blue part.
And that blue part is a big part of the minus pi to pi of the circle.
Let's think about how I could write that out. I'm going to write the blue part as, I'll call it I sub delta. It's going to be the t such that e to the it is not in that little disk of radius delta about e to the I theta.
That's where that thing is really small.
Okay, so that's the basic estimate I'm going to need. And it was just geometry. Then one more property is that if I take the Laplacian in the r theta variables, that Poisson kernel is harmonic for fixed t.
That's just something you can check. Actually, it's an easy thing to check because remember that thing was a sum of r to the n cosine n thetas? Each of those are harmonic in the r and theta.
So this follows because this thing is a sum. But you can also check it with your bare hands just by calculating. So that's just a calculation. I'll say that's a check. Okay, those are the four key properties that make this solve the Dirichlet problem. So the theorem is that if I define u of r theta to be this explicit integral from minus pi to pi, p of r theta t, f of t dt, solves the Dirichlet problem. Namely, the Laplacian of u is identically zero. Oh, I'll write it down here. So the Dirichlet problem is we want u to be harmonic. So that's on the disk of radius 1 about 0. And then we need to be u continuous up to the closure, continuous on the closed unit disk. So that includes the circle. And on the actual circle, we need u of 1 theta to be equal to the given boundary data, where this f thing is a continuous 2 pi periodic given function.
That solves the steady state heat problem with boundary conditions f of theta. Okay, so we came up with this formula by Fourier series, but now we can check all the facts just because of these properties of the Poisson kernel. So the proof is going to be a snap now.
we've seen the proof before when we played around with Thayer's kernel. So the first part, the Laplacian of that thing is zero because it's okay to differentiate under the integral sign. So it's okay to differentiate under the integral sign in the formula. That's not hard to figure out. You would just, you know, take partial, you take the difference quotient for partial derivatives and look at that integral and say, ha, there's no problem with me differentiating under the integral sign. I can just let the limits go under. It's a very straightforward thing to do. And you did it somewhere probably in sophomore calculus. But it's a very explicit thing to check. You've got that kernel right in front of you, and nothing goes wrong. So we can differentiate under the integral sign, and property 4, the Poisson kernel is harmonic. Okay, so that's an easy thing to check. The more interesting thing to check is to see that this function we come up with is continuous up to the boundary and has the right boundary values. So let's think about the difference between these things. This one is written as a Poisson integral. So this would be the integral from minus pi to pi of the Poisson kernel r theta of t of f of t dt. And this one, we've messed around like this before when we were looking at Thayer's kernel. This one I can write as f of theta times 1. And I'm going to write 1 in the form the integral of the Poisson kernel. So this is just another way to write 1.
But now I can stick this f of theta inside the integral and collect it all together.
And then I get something that's starting to look promising. This, when I collect it all together, would be an integral from minus pi to pi of the Poisson kernel. And then I would have f of t minus f of theta dt.
And now when you stare at that and realize, aha, this is small when t is near theta. But that's exactly where the Poisson kernel blows up. But it blows up in a way that's integrable. Whenever you integrate this thing, you get 1. So this little tiny epsilon that you get there times this, I can bound because the integral of this thing is 1. That's the key. And then if you think about, well, when t gets far away from theta, that's when I'm in the blue part. That's when the Poisson kernel is small. So it's going to be a way to control both things. I'll have one little spot where this is small, and the rest it's going to be where this is small. And I'm going to be able to control them both.
That's the beautiful analysis argument. We saw it first with the Thayer kernel. So let's think about it. I'm going to split this integral into two pieces. Namely, let's see, I want to be on the integral of the interval from minus pi to pi minus the I delta.
That's the blue stuff.
I'm sorry, did I call that I delta? Mm-hmm. This is what I called I delta, sorry. I delta is the blue part. That's where the p is small. As long as I've got the r e to the I theta in that little box, and then the rest would be the integral from minus delta to delta. So this is a plus. So on this region, on the blue part, this part's small.
And I can make it get as small as I want.
Because that 1 minus r on the top, if I make r e to the I theta close enough to the point, I can make this as small as I want. And this thing, because f is continuous, this is bounded. So just like in Fayer's theorem, this would be bounded by 2 times the bound for f, which I'll call m, just like in Fayer's. So if f is continuous, it's bounded. Say it's bounded by m, then this would be bounded by 2m. When I start taking I take absolute values. So that integral is the easy one to get bounded. I'll call that I1. And then this one, if f is continuous, I can choose my delta so that this is less than epsilon over 2 by continuity. And so let's see, this thing is going to be equal to the first integral plus the second integral. And I fix the deltas to make this less than epsilon over 2. That's how I choose my delta, by the definition of continuity. And then I can make that whole integral bounded because, let's see, the I2 is going to be less than or equal to the integral from minus delta to delta of PR theta t. Remember, the Poisson kernel is positive. So when I take the absolute value and stick it inside the integral, it doesn't affect this. It would affect this. So I get f of t minus f of theta dt. And so here I'm using in a key way that this is greater than 0. And now this is less than epsilon over 2. So this thing would be less than or equal to epsilon over 2 times the integral from minus delta to delta of the Poisson kernel. That's where the Poisson kernel is gigantic. But the total area of the Poisson kernel is at most 1. So in fact, this is less than or equal to, because the Poisson kernel is positive, this is less than or equal to the whole integral. So I'm using the fact that the Poisson kernel is positive again. And that's equal to 1. And so this is less than or equal to epsilon over 2. So the second integral I get controlled. And then I go back and look at the first integral, and that's the one I make to go to 0 by letting r go to 1. So finally, make integral 1 less than epsilon over 2 by making r e to the I theta go out to e to the I theta. So by letting r tend to 1 inside that disk. So we start out by being inside that disk where we get the estimate for the Poisson kernel, and that's all there is to it. So that's how you get a really hands-on proof that you've solved the Dirichlet problem. Any questions about that? It was easier to do in the case of the Fayer kernel because it was so concrete and maybe more straightforward. You've got more geometry to play around with, but it's exactly the same idea, and it comes up in lots of places in analysis. You might have noticed I went back and assigned some more problems from chapter 1. There's one that seemed too nice to pass up, so I want to give some hints about it. So this is homework. This is from homework 4. chapter 1, number 8. It's a nice problem. It's to study the symmetric difference quotient and show that it's the second derivative. That's a cool thing to know, and it comes up if you're going to do numerical analysis. But it's based on a second-order Taylor's formula for a function. So let me show you how you can deduce that. So here's some hints. So we're going to assume that capital F is C2 smooth. And so let's fix a point X. Then we're going to calculate, we can calculate a difference quotient. F of X plus H minus F prime of X. Since it's C2 smooth, this difference quotient would tend to the second derivative. So I'm not going to write tend. I'm going to write equals the second derivative at x plus an error function. And I think Stein wants us to call that error function psi of h. Okay, so that's just by the definition of the second derivative. That difference quotient tends to the second derivative. So this is going to give me that error function where psi of h tends to zero as h tends to zero. And I'm because of that, I can make psi continuous. I'm going to define psi of zero equals zero. That would make psi continuous. But now I'm going to solve this thing for f prime of x plus h. So call this star. I'm going to solve star, not circle. I'm going to solve star for phi prime of x plus h. When I do that, I would get phi prime of x plus h equals, let's say I multiply through by h, and I would get f prime of x plus f double prime of x times h plus phi of h times h. And now here's a cool thing to notice. This is true even when h is equal to zero. So I had something that wasn't defined when h was zero because it's a difference quotient. But this formula is true even if h is equal to zero. So that, and everything in sight is continuous in that problem, in this thing. So this thing is even true when h is equal to zero. And all, they're all continuous. And so the next step in Stein's argument is to integrate this. This is how you can get the Taylor expansion. This thing right here, when I integrate it with respect to h, is going to be a Taylor expansion. So this is the big hint then. Integrate that formula. Let's see, I'll call this formula dagger. With respect to h. And notice that this thing, by the chain rule, that's the derivative of f of x plus h. So note, f prime of x plus h equals d by dh of f of x plus h.
And so when I integrate the left-hand side from 0 to h?
So I'm going to integrate this thing, integral from 0 to h, dh. Well, let's see, I guess I should call it integrating from 0 to h. Yeah, so here's what I would do. I would have to write it like this, right? Integral from 0 to h, f prime of x plus tau d tau equals,
f prime of x is just a constant, so when I integrate 0 to h,
that's going to give me f prime of x times h.
And I'm going to integrate f double prime.
Let's see, this next one will give me an f double prime. That'll act like a constant. But then I'm going to be integrating 0 to h of tau d tau. And the last thing I'm going to be integrating is integral from 0 to h of phi of tau times tau d tau. That's going to be the error. And so let's see, when I do this, what am I going to get? When I use the fundamental theorem of calculus here, this would be f of x plus h minus f of x. And this one's going to be f prime of x times h. This one's going to be f double prime of x times h squared over 2. And this is going to be the error term in the Taylor expansion.
So I get this famous formula.
It's the Taylor's formula. F of x plus h is going to be equal to the Taylor expansion. F of x, here's the first order Taylor expansion. Here's the second order Taylor expansion. H squared over 2 factorial. And here's the error. And that
error is really small. Because look at it. Remember, the phi goes to 0 at 0. And I've got it multiplied by tau, which is really small. And I'm integrating over an interval that's really small.
So it is like triple small. And so your problem is going to be to estimate that error and show that it's small as you want.
And then you'll use this to see that the symmetric difference is going to go to the second derivative. You can do this for a plus h, and you can also do it for a minus h.
To get Stein's formula. So note, so the EH is going to be really small. Is it so small that it... You can divide by h squared and it still goes to 0. That's how small it is. And you have to check that. And another thing to note here is it's okay for the h to be negative. Same formula. With minus h in place of h. And once you have that, then you can do Stein's thing and analyze the symmetric difference using Taylor series. It's a cool thing to do. And we'll use it at some point in the future. So we'll have to do it in class when we need it. Any questions about that? I think with that hint, it won't be so hard to figure out what Stein's trying to tell you to do. I've got 5 more minutes. I'm going to take a break from this technical stuff and start playing around with sort of the big picture again. It'll feel a whole lot easier than what we've been doing. I want to start thinking about heat problems. And the heat problem I'm going to do is the most basic one. I call it the hot wire problem. And so I'm going to have a hot metal wire stretched out, say, between 0 and L.
And I'm going to and I want to analyze the temperature of that hot wire. And so
a neat thing to do is to deduce the heat equation. And I thought I would talk a little bit about it. Here's how you do it. So I would take a piece of the wire. Let's see, I would go from, say, X1 to X2.
And you know what a calorie is? So the calorie of a 1 calorie is the amount of heat it takes to raise 1 cubic centimeter of water 1 degree centigrade. So if you got a whole bunch of water that's hot, you can add up all those calories and figure out how much heat is in the bucket of water. Well, it's a similar thing here. The amount of heat in the piece of the wire going from X1 to X2 would be an integral of the temperature. So U of XT is going to be the temp at time T at point X. So the heat in that little chunk of wire is going to be an integral from X1 to X2 of the temperature, U of X dx. That's the number of calories in that thing. Can I do this?
I think I can do this. And so that heat in that thing is changing at a rate d by dt of that integral. So we'd have d by dt of that integral. And I can put that d by dt inside the integral. So that's going to be equal to the integral from x1 to x2 of du dt of xt dx.
But there's another way that heat is changing. Heat could be oozing in or out of either end of that thing.
So there's something called Kelvin's law.
The rate of heat flow is proportional to the temperature gradient.
So the rate that heat is flowing is proportional to the temperature gradient. Which is the derivative of the temperature.
So if you have a steep derivative, it means heat's flowing like crazy. If it's really hot over there and cool over here, it means that heat's gushing this way. Whereas if it's a level temperature gradient, then the heat's not flowing very much. Maybe it's good that I'm running out of time. I'm going to be able to write this the rate that the heat is changing. One is going to be this. And the other one's going to be, because of Kelvin's law, with heat oozing in or out on the either end point. When I equate those two things, I'm going to get the heat equation. So this is kind of the day I'm going to do physics instead of math. But it's a good thing for a mathematician to understand, because these important PDEs come from someplace. And so next time I'll give you the punchline of how this is going to connect and how we're going to get the heat equation out of it.
That's a good place to quit.
This lecture, can I turn the homework by email?
Well, you could turn it on Tuesday. I'd allow that. So are you not here?